So welcome, I'm Dr. Steve Bartels, I'm the director of the Centers for Health and Aging here. Just so you know a little bit about me, I happen to be a geriatric psychiatrist, although my area is overarching all of kind of geriatrics, so I help oversee aging here at Dartmouth, including the resource center that you may know about that you walk through here. We also have an education center for healthcare professionals where we teach doctors and nurses across northern New England about geriatrics. And we use this room actually and send out educational programs through this room, through the Geriatric Education Center. And then we also have some researchers who are doing research around a number of things, including healthy aging and Alzheimer's disease and a bunch of things that and how physical and mental health kind of work out together and come together. So that's what we are and who we are. We've been here for what?
I think since 2008.
Since 2008, kind of. Well, that's when we were living in a little building. Yeah. We've actually been in this building.
2010.
Since 2010. So we're really pleased to have the. Be lucky enough to get a fair amount of grants and to also have some support from the hospital and from the medical school, and also sometimes we also get donations. So that's who we are and that's who I am. So what I was going to do was to try to take a little bit of a whimsical approach to talking about healthy aging and the things that are associated with positive aging, but it's going to be scientifically based. In other words, I'm going to be talking about some of what we know about the things that contribute to so-called positive aging or successful aging, and provide some of the research on that, and also try to put it into a number of principles that we've learned about. But I'm also going to do that from kind of to give it a little bit of grounding from the perspective of the Land of Oz. And actually somebody said, do you mean Dr. Oz? And I said, no, Land Oz. We're not going to talk about diets and stuff. Actually, we are going to talk about diets, but we're not going to talk about the Oz diet. So it's a different Oz. It's the old Oz, not the new Oz. So what I want to talk a little bit about is kind of the challenge of aging and resisting, so-called resisting rust. Yeah, and one of the kind of things that we know, and I'll be talking about as we go through this this tour around healthy aging, is that a lot of healthy aging some way comes back to kind of having heart or having healthy heart. And that's in all the ways that you think about. There's not only having a heart that works well, but also in being physically healthy, but also a connection to other people having kind of a something that really matters to you as you get older and meaning in life. So part of this is in fact this idea of having a heart, and you probably recognize this little snippet here. Oops, is it supposed to? I'm not hearing it.
Try it on.
Suddenly it began to rain, and right in the middle of a chop, I rusted solid. Been that way ever since.
Well, you're perfect now.
My neck. Perfect? Oh, bang on my chest if you think I'm perfect. Go ahead, bang on it. Beautiful.
One nickel.
It's empty. The tinsmith forgot to give me a heart.
So
no heart?
No heart. All hollow.
So you'll see this theme as we go forward around kind of the various dimensions of kind of both cardiovascular health and having a heart and having connections as we go forward. So where do you start in thinking about this? So one way to think about where to start in terms of this theme of successful aging is to think about, kind of what are some of the definitions or the ways that people have thought about positive aging. And as you can see here, and I think you'd probably agree with this, that people have been looking at longevity, and I'll talk about that, you know, living longer. But I think for many people, it's not just about, and for most of it, it's not just about living longer. It's about living longer and better. It's about the quality of life. So you probably know people that have lived into later years, but are, you know, suffering from dementia or from other diseases, and it's not, or living in settings where they really don't want to live. And so our goal, obviously, is to think about how to help people to age in community and age in a way that allows them to have meaning and quality of life. So it's not just quantity, it's quality. And a lot of that isn't really magic. I mean, it both mental and physical functioning are key. We are, in fact, the mind and the body are, in fact, connected. We've known this from philosophers for years. It's what we call, sometimes, unfortunately, rediscovering the neck, you know, that just focusing on the head or focusing on the body, both are connected. But adjusting to normal changes associated with aging, and I'll talk about that, is critical. That as we age, we do have to develop certain types of accommodations. And preventing disability is important. So it's about adding life to years, not just years to life. And one of the researchers on aging talked about this concept called selective optimization with compensation. What does that mean? So selective optimization with compensation. And the way this person Baltes described it might be best illustrated in a little bit of a vignette or story. So somebody once asked the musician Rubinstein, you know, how do you, you know, here you are, you're playing these incredibly complicated piano sonatas, you know, in a great big concert hall at the age of 85. You know, how do you do that? How do you play so fast and so well? He said, well, I have a couple of secrets that I'd be happy to share with you. One is that I've selected a smaller number of things to focus on. I don't do all the pieces I used to. I don't do these Bach cantatas and these really other pieces. I focus on Chopin or whatever. I focus on a couple of musicians. So I select. Secondly, I selectively optimize. He didn't use that word, but what I do is I practice it a lot. So I selected, I don't do everything like I used to when I was younger, but what I do, I practice more. And then what I do is I compensate. So you know that section in the piece where I go really fast? Before it, I really slow down in ways that people may think that I'm playing much faster than I really am, because I'm not as fast as I used to be as a pianist. And so that's kind of a metaphor for what we do as we get older. We should be reaching out to do new things we've never done before, because that, and we'll talk about that, challenging the brain, exercising the brain is important. But among those things that are critical, that are important to us if we're continuing to work or focus on things that are meaningful, sometimes it means having to kind of practice a little bit more, narrow down a little bit the things that are most important, and then figure out a way to overcome any sorts of impediments or disabilities, so that if you have a hobby that's important to you, how do you kind of compensate for some of the things that you have that are limitations? So those are some of the things that people have thought about with successful aging, and we'll talk more about that. So here's a question, you know, here are a bunch of twins. How much of your longevity is predicted by genes? Anybody want to guess?
80%.
Do you think 80? Any other?
80, 100?
Whoa, wow.
No, I would guess 80.
You think
80?
I'd say 33.
You're saying 33. There, okay. So part of the answer is, it kind of depends on what you mean. If you're talking, and we'll talk a little bit in a couple of minutes, in terms of the so-called supercentenarians, the people that are 110 or 100, then more of the variance in longevity is associated with genes. But in terms of just longevity in general for all of us, if you look at twins that were raised apart, that's why I showed those pictures of twins, and you look at, they're born, they're identical twins, they were raised apart in different places, and you want to know, did they both make it to the same endpoint in terms of age? Not always. And what we do know is that genetics, you're more close in terms of physical, in terms of the entire lifespan, not in terms of people who only reach old age, but in terms of everybody across the entire lifespan. Physical aging, about 30% is genetics. Mental functioning, about 50. So what's the other stuff? Boy, lifestyle, all over the place, right? So if you look at the determinants of health, if you think about, if you have a big pie and you want to know in that pie how much of your health is accounted for by healthcare, by doctors like me, what do you think? How much of your health is accounted for by what your doctor does?
10%.
Exactly, 10%. How much is health behavior? It's actually about 40 to 50%. Then about 30% is genes, and the rest is environment. So 10% doctor, healthcare, about 40 to 50%, depending on what you're looking at, health behavior, what you eat, what you do, whether you smoke, whether you exercise, you know.
Where you live.
Well, that's environment. Environment is about 20%.
You choose where you live at.
That can make a big difference, right.
It is. So I'd say it's 100%.
Well, it depends on how you bucket it. That's a good point. So genetics is about 30%. So that means that you actually can make a difference. Unfortunately, you can't choose again your parents. You know, so you can't do that again. You know, you got your parents who you got. You can't choose your genes. Although maybe some of this genetic stuff that's being done might violate that premise in the future. But the exception is for exceptional longevity, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But environmental actions, interactions are key. So modifiable things, you know this, exercise, diet, coping styles, social support are important. So this kind of gets us to what will really be the focus of this talk. So a friend of mine, Bob Butler, who is this wonderful geriatrician, he was the first director. He established the National Institute of Aging. He just died this past year. He was a wonderful, wonderful man, wonderful mentor, and terrific physician who's very fascinated by the whole idea of aging. And he wrote this book called The Longevity Prescription, The 8 Proven Keys to a Long and Healthy Life. It's a good book. It was published in 2010. I'd recommend it to you if you're interested. I said, well, 8 plus 2. So among the things that I'm going to be going over are maintaining kind of mental vitality, and we'll talk about that, nurturing relationships, sleep actually, you know, good sleep does have a relationship towards actually healthy aging, we know that, stress and how you manage stress, important, living an active life, nutrition, practicing prevention. You know, prevention we always think about with kids. The secret is geriatrics is about 90% prevention. So what we do around preventing falls, preventing strokes, preventing bad things from happening, also taking people off of lots of medications that are sometimes interacting, that's all prevention. So people think, oh no, prevention is for kids, for young people. Not true. Most of geriatrics is prevention. Taking charge of your health, I kind of added. And then connecting with your community, he had in there. And then writing your last chapter, I added too. So these are the 10 kind of points that we'll go over around prescription for longevity and for healthy aging. So I'll be going over each of those. So first, maintaining mental vitality and brain health. And you'll remember, I think, this little snippet.
Ooh, why, if I had a brain, I could while away the hours, conferring with the flowers, consulting with the rain. And my head, I'd be scratching while my thoughts were busy hatching if I only had a brain. I'd unravel every riddle for any individual in trouble or in pain.
With the thoughts you'd be thinking, you could be another Lincoln if you only had a brain.
Oh, I will tell you what.
I think we've enough of that. So I think that and this is kind of humorous about having a brain, but as you probably know, at least when I talk to older adults, and we're very interested in memory problems, you know, and here at the center, is that most people will say, and I certainly feel this way myself as I anticipated getting older, I think I can probably deal with aches and pains and some of the difficulties of arthritis and even physical limitations. And many people go through the tragedy of having to kind of deal with cancer and come out the other side, or still have to know that the clock is ticking. But I think most people feel, I think, that the thing that most is most of concern is losing your ability to recognize people, to interact with people, and to lose your cognitive capacity. That's kind of one of the things that we deal a lot with here, and is among the things that are most important. So how do we think about maintaining mental vitality? And what's important is to know that there are two types of so-called intelligence, or two types of mental functioning that researchers talk about. One is called crystallized intelligence, and the other is called fluid intelligence. What does that mean? So crystallized intelligence means the things that you practice over and over and over again and have kind of become part of your everyday routine and your knowledge set. So these are things that again, whether it's doing the work that you do, or playing a musical instrument that you do that you're familiar with doing, or how you get around town, or the knowledge that you bring, your profession that you had, you know, the specific thing that you did for work, or your knowledge of your children, those things are well practiced and well known. Now, fluid intelligence is the type of thing that is novel, something you've never done before, or where you have to really react immediately to changing situations and to new types of challenges. If you look at what happens with aging, crystallized intelligence and memory pretty much stays close to the same. It diminishes a little bit. What we start to lose at the age of 40 is this fluid intelligence, your ability to kind of deal with very novel, very new things, and to think creatively. So there's no mystery why, if you go to a software company and you look at the factory where the people are making their new programs, they all look like they got kids with acne, you know, they're all 17 or 20, and, you know, and they're doing this kind of out-of-the-box thinking that no one's ever done before around computer programming or making new apps. So that's, and then also, you know, I once had this experience that was kind of interesting, where I was reading a book on kind of aging, you know, and I'm sitting next to somebody, and he looked over my shoulder, and this is on a plane, and he said, "Oh, that you're interested in aging and stuff." And "Oh yeah, yeah, it happened to me." And he said, "Well, you know, I used to go through all these tests over my career on how I was doing as I got older." And I said, "Really?" I said, "I bet you're a pilot." He said, "Exactly." He said that, and because pilots go through these tests throughout their career that are commercial pilots around reaction time and novel problem solving and these simulators and stuff. And so some of the best data on how we know that people age over the years was based on these assessments of pilots over time. You know, when you get in a new, where the buzzers start going off and you've never done this before and you've got to. So what he said to me was, he said, and this was a number of years, he said, "Do you remember that?" He said, "I got a question for you, because since you're interested in this area," he said, "do you remember that plane that was landing in Hawaii? Did everyone ever remember this, where the whole top ripped off? Do you remember the pictures?" Mm-hmm. It was a plane that was going to land in Hawaii.
5 years ago?
It was about 5 or 6 years ago, and the whole top of the plane ripped off. And it severed the connection between the steering column and the rudder on the back. And everyone thought it was amazing. This pilot landed it, and nobody died, even though you could see the picture when they're coming in, and people are flapping in the breeze, you know? I mean, it was really amazing. At least, I'm not sure. Maybe one of the flight attendants got tragically blown out. But most of the people survived. And they had to literally bank the plane by throttling back and forth on the engines to make it turn and do some things that no one had ever thought about. This had never happened before, that the whole top of the roof would fall. And there was a pilot who was about to retire. It's like the Scully thing, right? You know, the senior guy,
Sully.
About Sully. Okay, was about to retire, and then there was a young junior pilot. So he said, "Who do you think was at the controls?" The guy with all the experience or the young kid?
The young kid.
The young kid. Why? That's exactly
because
right.
Because he's able to sort of just come up with all kinds of options real fast.
And particularly reaction time, right?
Right, his reaction time.
But who was the guy with all the wisdom who had been in multiple flight simulators forever and was kind of telling him what to do and giving him advice? The CEO. I mean, the senior pilot, which is why big companies, except for software companies, have older people who have wisdom, who have crystallized intelligence. They've seen it all. They are there to kind of offer mentoring and guidance to the kids, the younger people, who haven't seen it all, but they don't have to have seen it all because they think of solutions we don't think of anymore. That ability to think of things you've never done before wanes, and to do very novel things with your brain starts declining at the age of 40. The good news is practice things stay pretty good until late life, except for things like looking for your keys and where you park your car, and that's normal. And so the interesting thing is that yes, you should practice these things, but also challenging those things you don't do and exercising that brain, it actually has been shown in some instances to be helpful in terms of improving capacity and improving kind of brain functioning over time. So yes, there seems to be some value in taking up. I have a friend who's my age, and he just took up the drum kit. He's got, I said, really? I said, yeah. I said, I've always wanted to play drums. So he's taking lessons now from the same teacher who taught my son, who's a professional drummer now. So he's my age. He's taking a drum. Well, that's not a bad thing to do. Or taking up, something new and challenging yourself. But that's pushing that so-called fluid intelligence, the thing we really don't naturally keep. While practicing the learned stuff and banking on your wisdom is what we all do, and this is why we, again, CEOs tend to be older and run things. Now, memory disorders are different things, right? And it, as I say, it's really the number one worry, I think, of aging adults is keeping your cognitive capacity. So here's another pop quiz. So which one of these is best in terms of nutrition for maintaining the growing the aging human brain? Omega-3 fish oil, spinach, ginkgo, biloba extract, or choline supplements?
Omega-3?
Choline? You like choline? You like fish oil?
Spinach.
Spinach? So, who knows, right? Now, we're really not sure. All of these have some putative value. In other words, which one's better is not clear, and this is a bit of a trick question. I mean, there is some... Omega fish oil has been shown to be particularly good with respect to kind of a vascular illness, decreasing cardiovascular, opening up some of your capillaries in your brains. Spinach obviously is high in nutrients. Ginkgo extract also has some memory enhancing. Choline, acetylcholine is the memory drug.
What is 3 and 4?
Well, ginkgo is this root that people take that can help a little bit with memory. Choline, the memory chemical in your brain is called acetylcholine.
Okay.
When you have less of that, you have Alzheimer's.
Right.
So choline supplements can help a little bit. But the real reason why I put this up, the real question, this was kind of a bit of a trick. One of the things is maybe what you do is at least as important as what you eat. So eating, the diet's important. But this friend of mine also, Gene Cohen, who wrote this interesting book called The Creative Age, and a wonderful guy who also unfortunately passed away in the last couple of years. He wrote, what nourishes the brain far more than any of the above than these nutrients, especially for those in the second half of life, is creativity, or what medical literature calls a challenging and rich environment. So how do we know that? How do we know that a challenging and rich environment makes a difference? Well, there have been studies with mice and rats where they've been placed in environments that are so-called that are spare environments with very little stimulation, no toys, no spinning wheels, no nothing. And then they're the same rats or twins have been separated, and those have been put in enriched environments where they have toys to play with, things and lots of stuff going on. What has been really interesting in those studies has been that there's a chemical that increases when you put mice in enriched environments, stimulating environments, creative environments, that goes up. It's called, the short term is called BDNF, which is a fancy term, a kind of abbreviation for brain-derived neurotrophic factor. Brain-derived, you made it. It's not, it's, you're making it every day. It's brain-derived. It's a hormone that you make in your brain. Brain-derived neurotrophic, neuro, nerves, trophic, grow. It's a chemical that you produce in your brain that actually grows nerve cells. So when they harvested these brains, when they looked at the brains of these mice that had everything else was different except for the stimulating environment, they had higher brain-derived neurotrophic factor, this chemical, and they had developed more connections in their brain. Now, they also did this in midlife, in middle-aged rats. Same thing. So another thing that can increase BDNF, as I'll talk in a couple minutes, one is stimulating environments, enriched environments. The other actually is exercise. If you do aerobic exercise, you will increase your BDNF, your brain-derived neurotrophic factor.
Really?
You will increase the hormone that creates more connections in your brain.
Why?
Why? God made it that way. I don't know. The more you exercise, the more you create, you know, part of it, people talk about this endorphin rush, which also get, you know, I'm a runner, so I like that, you know. It's also the case that in addition to your kind of endorphin kind of stimulus, you actually are producing a bit more of this hormone that causes more brain connections to happen through this brain-derived neurotrophic factor. So what you do, being in a stimulating environment, whether that's social or creative environment, is, and then also exercise, are both actually can help grow, believe it or not, more connections in your brain. So what he did, what Gene did, this that he published a number of years ago, he actually did a randomized trial. This is really interesting. Only Gene Cohen would do this. You know, we randomize, we do these studies comparing drug A to drug B or this, that, or the other. He randomized people, assigned 166 healthy adults to either a choral group, a singing group, or a art group, or just usual, what they did. And what he found over time, he followed these people over a number of years, and what he found was that those people who had been randomly assigned, they flipped a coin, you go over here, we're actually going to put you in a choir, even if you don't sing too bad, you're going to go sing, or even if you don't paint, you're going to paint. And the other people said, just do what you want, and we'll follow you. We'll just, you know, interview every 6 months or 3 months. Well, the people who were assigned to the choral, to the cultural program, had higher all subjective physical health. They described feeling healthier, had fewer doctor visits, less medication use, fewer falls, and fewer health problems, and less loneliness and greater involvement in activity. Kind of interesting. I mean, he also looked at painting and writing and poetry. It's not the most rigorous scientific study you've ever seen, but it's really interesting. I mean, it's the only study I know where someone actually took the time to randomly flip a coin and put people in a cultural group who were older and see how they did. And obviously, there may be some reasons to explain this, like just getting people together to do stuff together helps, you know. So was it just the painting or the singing, or was it getting people together to do something fun together? Who knows? It almost doesn't matter. What we know is the more you're socially involved in things that are stimulating you, whether it's social conversation, whether it's playing games, or whether it's doing a choral group or painting or doing Tai Chi, all of these things are likely to actually result in better health outcomes, including, interesting enough, fewer falls and fewer emergency room visits and stuff. That's kind of interesting.
Really?
So I already talked about this. I already jumped ahead with this, which was that, we know from lab animals that enriched environments, cages with wheels, toys, playthings, compared to animals raised in sterile environments, result in thicker cerebral cortexes. That's the layer of your brain. That's the outside of your brain, the thicker, and more connections, more synapses. Now you could ask, does this work for humans? No one's done a study, to my knowledge, where people have actually looked at, did imaging studies or looked at brains after kind of stimulating activity. But we have gotten to the point now where we can measure this chemical BDNF. And guess what? Particularly with exercise, physical exercise, humans' BDNF goes up. And there's also some question about it going up some in stimulating, challenging mental environments. So, you know, we talk about it's good to exercise and good to keep your stimulating. There may actually be a biological basis that is not just heart health, but actually where you're literally producing more of a hormone that's creating more connections in your brain, which is really cool if you think about it. I mean, you probably learned like I did, you have only so many brain cells and you just lose them as you get older and you can't grow anything new. It's a lie. I mean, people, that's been actually, you actually can grow more connections and more things. I mean, again, it is true as we get older, the brain shrinks a little bit, as everything else does as we get older. But it is the case, connections is really what it's at, is where it's at. It's about the connectivity now. More and more at the National Institute of Health, we're studying, we used to just study brain size and kind of shape. Now it's all about connectivity. The number of connections in your brain is associated with all sorts of things, both good and, if their connections aren't good, bad things too. So we know something about that. And we know, as I mentioned to you, this issue of if you want to maintain mental vitality, you know, it really is about some of these things. You've heard it, and it's like, oh no, not another, you know, eat well and exercise. I mean, I know you've heard this before, but it really is true that the lifestyle things are so important. As I mentioned, you know, 40 to 50% of your physical health is due to your lifestyle. So exercising, not smoking, is just really, really important, and good nutrition. Now, people sometimes say to me, well, I've read all this stuff about red wine, right? You've read about it, right? You know, a glass of red wine preserves your brain. It is true that studies of big populations, those people who have a glass of red wine several times a week, tend to have better health outcomes and better cognitive functioning as they age. So here's a question. What's wrong with that correlation, that association, if you're a scientist?
Alcohol numbs your mind.
So alcohol may not be that good for everybody.
Cause effect.
Say more about that.
Sometimes people understand it the opposite of what it really is. We don't know whether it's...
So maybe people who function a little better or a little healthier are a little more likely to have a glass of red wine. Now think about it. You know, who is it that has one glass of Cabernet every night? Is it the worker who's been working in the coal mine, who's exposed to asbestos, who's overweight because he's eating unhealthy food, and the person usually, again, unfortunately, there is a socioeconomic part of this. People who are in higher socioeconomic settings tend to have less environmental bad exposures, and it probably is the case that people have one glass of red wine, not 10 bottles of red wine, one glass, probably there's something else going on. So first of all, it's a little suspect. I mean, that doesn't mean that there isn't chemicals in the red wine that have been shown to be helpful. There have. But what I like to say to people is that if you have a choice between sitting in your chair, your rocking chair, having a glass of red wine, and maybe even doing a crossword puzzle, which is good, and going for a walk, go for the walk. Exercise your fit, you know, do the walk, go around, get off your butt and go around the block and do some good aerobic exercise, because at the end of the day, you know, your blood pressure, your lipids and your heart health and your vascular health are probably the one thing that most affect cognitive health, and it's something you can do something about, you know, and so that we know that more and more, even though, for example, for Alzheimer's and other cognitive impairment disorders, there's a neurological part of it. More and more we're understanding that there's a real connection with vascular health. So if you have heart health, if you don't smoke, if you take care of your weight, if you exercise, if you control your blood lipids and your blood pressure, your likelihood of brain health is much, much better. And furthermore, you can do something about that. You may not be able to do something about the fact that you're in a family that's had lots of early Alzheimer's. You can't change your genes, but you can definitely change your exposure to toxins to some extent, and heart health. So exercise, smoking, blood pressure, lipids, we tell everybody, you know, make sure you're controlling those sorts of things. And those things, when they're higher, people, there's a higher risk of Alzheimer's with people with diabetes. Why is that? It's all because of this vascular connection. Diabetes is associated with vascular changes. That's why people with diabetes are more likely to get blindness and problems with their feet. The little capillaries start to shut down. It also has the same thing for the brain. So vascular health important. Wow. Secondly, intellectual stimulation is good. We talked about the cognitive calisthenics. You know, does what's that program now that everyone's you hear it on NPR?
Luminosity.
Does luminosity really work? They claim it does. It was designed by neuroscientists. Of course it worked. Well, you know. But what we do know is that these brain-challenging exercises do result in better ability over time to do brain-challenging exercises. That's not bad. Does it generalize? Will you, if you do these brain-challenging exercises, will you suddenly, you know, will you get a Nobel Prize in some an unrelated area? Will you suddenly have thoughts you've never had before? We don't really know. But we do know that you can train your brain to be more flexible and more capable. In the same way, if you go to the fitness club, you know, and you start to lift weights, you can start to lift heavier weights. Does that mean that everything else about your life is going to be better? Maybe, maybe not. So cognitive calisthenics work in terms of training your brain to do better functioning, better reaction time within that frame of cognitive calisthenics. The big question is, do those things generalize to the rest of your life? If you do these things, if you spend half an hour a day doing luminosity, will you otherwise be smarter in everything else you do? Or should have you taken that half an hour and done the thing you should have done instead of, I don't know. I mean, we don't really know. But it certainly can't hurt you and is likely to be challenging, again, challenging that kind of fluid intelligence that I talked about earlier. We know is good and helps. So taking on new challenges. Now, this is George Valiant, who some of you may recognize because he was at Dartmouth for a while. He lived over in Norwich and was also a friend of mine who did this really interesting study. So George, a number of years ago, when he was much younger than he is in that picture, he was interested in doing some research and on kind of function, on kind of outcomes of people over time. And he came upon, when he was at Harvard at the time, and somehow he came upon this treasure trove of boxes that were from this thing called the Grant Study. And the Grant Study, for several years, exquisitely characterized every single student who came into Harvard University. Now, they were all men at the time, so that's restricted. But everybody got a physical exam. They got all sorts of cognitive tests. They had all these psychological interviews. They had questions about their family history. I mean, they had everybody who walked in for like 4 years had all this information. Well, when he found these boxes, those people were all in their middle age. So he wrote a grant to find these folks, to find these Harvard graduates. And he went and interviewed every single one. And then every year thereafter, went back and interviewed them again. For like years, for decades. So it became this longitudinal study of the Harvard study of adult development, where he literally studied adult development going forward. Because if you think about it, if I decided to study kind of aging and how people age from the time they're 20 to the time they're 80, it wouldn't work as a researcher, right? You could probably predict that I wouldn't make it. If I start with someone who's 20 and I want to know how they're doing at 80, it's not going to work. The math doesn't work. So what he did was he found all these people that were described and then went forward. And what he found was that before the age, if you look, then recently, more recently, these people now are no longer students or no longer in the middle age. They're now in their 70s and 80s. Actually, some of them are even older than that. And he's gone back and interviewed all these people that have had careers and lives, and they've been captains of industry or doctors or physicians or teachers or lawyers or plumbers or whatever. Not that many plumbers probably from Harvard, I don't know. But they have gone into different walks of life. And what he found was that the people who before the age of 50 ended up aging well, doing well, the people who are doing well at the age of 70 to 80, before the age of 50. This is what they look like. They're less likely to have smoked. Big surprise. They're less likely to have had a history of alcohol abuse. But what's interesting, they were much more likely to, when you did these psychological tests, they're much more likely to have a good sense of humor. They were much more likely to be funny in the interview and kind of have a happy-go-lucky way about them. They also were more likely to anticipate and look forward than to look back and regret. So the people that were like, oh, but yeah, well, how are you doing, George? And I haven't talked to her. Fred, I haven't talked to you. You know, this is my interview. Oh, well, I'm thinking again about the thing I should have done with my son and the investment I should have made and that screw up I did. Those people didn't do as well. These people said, you know, I'm doing great. You know, I'm really thinking about taking up a new sport, or I'm really planning on doing a great trip that I'm going to be doing, whatever. But I'm also thinking about the fact that my wife is getting a little more frail, and I'm eventually going to maybe be on my own, and I've got to think about how am I going to adjust to that. I'm anticipating. People who have had recurrent major depression don't do as well, and obviously people with good physical health. Nothing magic there. I mean, it's kind of like, yeah, so why would we expect anything different? But these are things that kind of predicted forward. Aging well were these sorts of characteristics. So the second thing, in addition to kind of this issue of kind of taking care of your brain and challenging yourself, is this issue of relationships. So what we know is we really do know that. Connectivity in later life, being part of a social network, is real. There's lots of research on this. It actually results in better outcomes. So people ask me sometimes, they say, how do I age in place? And I say, you don't want to age in place. You want to age in community. You want to age with other people. That the person, the Yankee who wants to be in my home, you know, whatever happens, I want to live in my home, you know, and I'm alone, but I like being alone. As he or she gets more frail and doesn't have connections and isn't going out, isn't going to do as well as the person who is engaging with other people in social activities, going to Iliad or going to out and getting together, playing cards with people. And we know this, the health is better. I mean, the people who are more likely to be involved in social relationships, if they've had a heart attack, they're less likely to die. People with cancer, we know that T cell counts, the things that fight off cancer cells, are higher in people with more social networks. Isn't that interesting? We're social animals. So you actually are more likely to do better in terms of cancer or heart attacks if you have a big social network than if you have a small one and you're trying to do it alone. So social connectivity is actually good for health and good for aging. And so trying to think about how to be positive, to practice acceptance and forgiveness, but also knowing how to say no is okay. You know, if you can't do it, you can't do it. Making new friends, pushing yourself, maintaining intimacy, and kind of the issue of touch. You know, we're told that, you know, we know from lots of research that kind of human touch is important. Even though those of us who are psychiatrists were never supposed to touch anybody. So, anyways. Of course, we take blood pressures now, or I teach my doctors to do that now. So so sleep is important. And again, you know, sleep hygiene is really important. As you get older, sleep architecture changes. You know, you have more restless sleep. You know, you're more likely to have awakenings. When I was an undergraduate student, I spent a year in a sleep lab doing research. And we had people come in. It was really interesting. I'd sit there all night and I'd watch these little EEG things go up and down and see when people are dreaming and when people are in deep sleep. And deep sleep, which is not dreaming sleep, decreases. This thing called delta or slow wave sleep decreases as you get older. And that's actually the restorative sleep. Probably REM sleep, this kind of rapid eye movement dream sleep, probably also has some restorative functioning. That gets a little more fragmented as we get older, too. So, unfortunately, you have to actually work harder to kind of have good sleep when you get older. So, for my wife, what this means is she never did eat much chocolate, never was much of a drinker, but she can't have a glass of wine and she can't drink chocolate, and she can't have chocolate anymore because it kills her sleep. It just does. She says, I maybe take a sip of that because it's really special and it's an occasion, but she's learned that if she doesn't go for that walk an hour a day, and she does, and she eliminates caffeine, including caffeine and chocolate, and she never has coffee. If she has caffeinated coffee, chocolate, or alcohol, her sleep goes, you know, it's gone, you know. So she otherwise sleeps fine, but she's got to take care of her sleep. Same thing, as we get older, things change. But we do know that people who have lower risk of lower sleep, have more fragmented sleep, are more likely to have cardiovascular events that result in death, have heart attacks that kill them, which is kind of interesting. We also know that immune function, and you know this, when do you get your cold? When do you get your virus? When you were on that plane or you stayed up too late? And, you know, when you're run down, so-called, yes, your immune function is worse. And what do? When we're really sick, we go to bed and we sleep. Sleep does restore immune function. And so your immunity is better. And actually, we know that people who sleep less have poorer cognitive capacity, which worries me a little bit because I sleep on the short side. I get up really early to write, you know, so whether that impairs my memory or not, I don't know, but it might. But people who sleep less than 7 hours are more at risk for cognitive problems, which again, maybe that's why I sometimes don't know where my keys are. So again, keeping busy, high sleep hygiene, caffeine, alcohol, medication. Some of the medications you're on can be stimulants. If you are on a new medication and you're finding you can't sleep, it may be the medication. Steroids can absolutely cause you to get jazzed up and not sleep well. Anything that has to do with breathing medications, things that open up your airways also are stimulants. Sometimes, you know, as we get older, you know, you have to think about whether you're going to be getting up to void in the middle of the night. Naps can be helpful. Sleep medications are meant to be brief. The longer you're on these sleeping medications, sometimes they have a paradoxical effect where they start to impair sleep because you withdraw from them, even those that are not meant to be addictive. And Benadryl, diphenhydramine, like Tylenol PM, is not good for old people. And the reason for that is that Benadryl is what's called anticholinergic. It makes you have dry mouth. You know, whenever you have Benadryl, you dry mouth. Well, what did I say was the brain chemical that is associated with memory? The more of it you have, your memory works a little bit better.
Acetylcholine.
So anticholinergic means anti-acetylcholine. It prevents acetylcholine from being released from the neuroreceptors. So if you already have a little bit of memory problems and you take something that's anticholinergic like Benadryl, it actually makes your thinking worse. You will not think as clearly. So there are a number of these medications that are anticholinergic, some antidepressants are anticholinergic, that can actually impair sleep. Tylenol PM is not a good medication for older people. Diphenhydramine, Benadryl also, not good because it impairs. If you already are having, as we get older, we start to drop our levels of acetylcholine naturally, again, which may have to do with the car keys, I don't know. Benadryl, things that dry out your mouth, medications of that sort, actually can impair cognitive function. Also, so paradoxically, you're taking them to sleep better, you may be sleeping a little better, but you may be thinking a little worse. So think about that. Not all sleep medications. So, stress. How do you manage stress? So, you probably remember this guy.
Gee, that's awfully nice of you. My life has been simply unbearable.
Oh, well, it's all right now. The wizard will fix everything.
It's been in me so long. I just gotta tell you how I feel.
Well, come on.
Yeah, it's sad, believe me, Missy, when you're born to be a sissy without the feminine vibe. But I could show my prowess, be a lion, not a mouse, if I only had the nerve.
So I'll stop that. But so having the nerve, managing stress is really important because, as you know, that as we look at kind of people who have been significantly stressed, that they, this is toxic to your heart, your immune system, and your brain. So have you heard about adverse childhood events, what are called ACE? Haven't heard that? So ACE, A-C-E, are things called adverse childhood events. And recent research in the last couple of years has shown that people who have had lots of adverse childhood events, who have been physically traumatized, sexually abused, have had a lot of things happen bad when they were kids, are more likely when they get older to have diabetes, heart disease, and chronic medical illnesses. So what's thought is that when you are chronically and repeatedly stressed when you are a child, or let's say not when you're a child, you heard about the flight-fight response, flight-fight, so you know you a bear is coming after you, right?
Bear, yeah.
So your heart starts to go faster, your epinephrine, you know, your the kind of chemical that kind of gets your heart rate up and gets you hyper-aroused. You know, you are really hypervigilant. You don't want to get killed by this bear. Your body reacts. That's what we call fear, right? And what happens also is your stomach kind of, the blood that goes to your stomach starts going out to your legs and to your arms and to your muscles because you better run, you know, fight and flight. Now, if it's a bear, that's good. But what about if you're just anxious all the time, or if you have been repeatedly threatened by a father or a parent or whatever who's yelling at you, abusing you, throwing things or whatever? What that means is you are chronically having this stimulus response where you are hyper aroused and you're producing all of this chemical, epinephrine and other sorts of things, that actually over the long run, it's good if you're going to run, it's not good if it's all the time. And so what happens is that's a stress chemical, and it starts to stress your heart and your immune system and your system and your brain over time. So what that all means is even if you have trouble managing stress, it's a really good idea to figure out how to manage that stress better. So meditation and mindfulness and some of the things people do, people have known this, philosophers and societies and cultures, that these sorts of stress management strategies are really important for your health. They really are. Yoga, things like that. So this is one of the oldest living persons. She lived at the age of 122. And so people asked her, and her father, she had some good longevity. They asked her, so what is it that you think made you live so long? Makes you live so long. She says, well, if you can't do anything about it, don't worry about it. Easier said than done. But it kind of does speak this issue of that worrying unproductively is just not good, you know, and some people are better at this. You know, some people are able to say, you know, that's done. You can't do anything about that. Just look forward, look for the opportunities, but don't look back. Don't always be kind of criticizing yourself or beating yourself on the back or telling yourself that, gosh, if you'd just done such and such. There's nothing constructive about that. People who think forward and don't do that do better in terms of health, yeah.
I heard a quote years ago that said, you're old when you have more regrets than dreams.
Yeah, that's a good idea, yeah. You're older, you're perhaps another way to think about it is, this person didn't have regrets. You're physiologically old.
Right.
You're 60 or whether you're 80 or 90.
Exactly. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
You can be 25.
Yeah. If you are more sitting around regretting, you probably are mentally getting old. And
right.
It's not, you can keep young if you're trying to focus on the positive. But it's easier said than done. It's kind of the glass half full as opposed to half empty, right? So we do know a little bit about positive outlook. So I don't know whether you've ever heard about the Nunn study. But this is a really interesting study that was done by this researcher by the name of David Snowden. And he was interested in Alzheimer's. And he was interested in trying to, what he found, almost like George Vaillant. He said, gosh, you know, he met this nun, this really nice nun, and they're having this conversation. And somehow he said, oh, I'm a neuroscientist, and I'm really interested in Alzheimer's and how people live over the years and live well. She said, well, I live really well. I've lived my whole life. I've lived in a cloistered nunnery. We don't have alcohol. We are in an environment which is stimulating. We eat healthy food. you know, we have a really nice society, and we'd be happy to help with your research in Alzheimer's if you're interested, because we have all this information on us when we first came into the nunnery, you know, and we've lived together for all these years. He said, well, do you think we could have your brains to look at, you know, because I'm really into so. He said, sure, I bet you we could get the nuns. So anyways, what happened is that he did this nun study where he went back and he looked at the writings of these nuns when they first came into the novitiate, into the nunnery. And then he looked at those who developed Alzheimer's or didn't age well downstream. Now, one of the reasons why this was a good group to look at is because, again, it was a pure, all the things you think about, environmental exposures that are different. You know, you live in a different place than you live, than I live. They all lived in the same place their whole life, except when they were little girls. They all ate the same food. They presumably didn't have sex and get exposed to kind of infectious diseases that were outside of it. And they didn't engage in alcohol abuse, we think, in general. And they had kind of the same environment. So what a good place to figure out what really matters in terms of good functioning. So what she found, he started looking at these biographies of these girls when they applied, when they were 16 or 15 or 14, when they applied to the nunnery even. And what she found was that sisters who, when they came in, expressed early on happiness, love, hope, and kind of positive frames, lived a lot longer than the people who expressed kind of negative sadness, feelings of shame and guilt. That was really interesting. Now, the other thing you found, which is a little bit kind of worrisome, I thought, was that he also found that those nuns, when you looked at their writings, that had more complex sentence structures, complex thoughts, as young girls, were less likely to get Alzheimer's later. Which is kind of a bummer if you think about it. It went way back to then. It's like, oh my goodness. But what I think what that means, again, is that people, these girls had more probably connections in their brain and had more cognitive reserve. They had more kind of stuff, because they had more complex thoughts when, and these weren't complex in the sense of really, but the sentences were just more, if you looked at their sentences, you could see very simple sentences with very simple thoughts, and then a little bit more nuanced, more interesting sentences to read. Those nuns were less likely years later to develop Alzheimer's. So again, this idea of stimulation even early, this idea of cognitive reserve, and this idea of a positive outlook. So I am going to go to 5:30, I guess, or at least quarter past. So this is that kind of picture that I talked about, which is that being depressed is not good in terms of your outcome, in terms of life. That this is a, these are people that are not depressed, these are people that are depressed. This is heart attack and likelihood to die. If you're depressed, you're less likely to live after a heart attack. If you're not depressed, you're more likely to live. So this whole thing of the mind-body connection is really important, really important. So set stress aside, you know, music, exercise, hobbies, Tai Chi, meditation, they really are, they're not just kind of fads. These really things are important for health. Simplifying, reducing multitasking, good luck, you know, right? Yeah. In this day and age. Caffeine, multitasking and caffeine sounds like my job in my life. So it's what I do. Accepting what you can't change, and accepting if you need help, accepting help. We've talked about kind of this active life. Again, heart health, I've mentioned this, is really important. What's particularly interesting is this issue. We have a researcher here by the name of John Batsis, who's one of our geriatricians. He's very interested in this phenomenon called sarcopenia. What does that mean? It means that tragically, as we get older, we start losing muscle mass. And so what it means is that we always have to work. It's not just about aerobic exercise, which is really good for pumping, getting the heart going, and having better vascular health in your brain, but also as we get older, our bones start to get a little more frail. We lose calcium, we get osteoporosis, and we also lose muscle mass. So it is actually good to figure out ways to be involved in kind of strength building exercise. It's limited and safe as you get older, because you're going to lose your upper body strength and you lose your core strength. If you lose your core strength, your balance is worse. If you lose your balance, you're more likely to fall. You fall, you break your hip, and then you know where that goes. So it really is the case that dementia falls and fractures were more likely. So exercise is not only important for the heart health, but also for bone strength. So decrease osteoporosis, decrease falls, and improve reaction time and cholesterol levels, all sorts of stuff. So it may sound like I'm a little bit of a kind of one-tone person, but here's some data about late life exercise. 16 years after follow-up in people middle age and later, this is disability over time. So these down here have low disability, these have high disability. These are people who exercise their whole life. These are people who started exercising late in life. In other words, the people who started exercising in late life did almost as good in terms of reducing disability than those people you can't stand that have been exercising their whole life and are in great shape. You know? These are people who were always couch potatoes and people who became couch potatoes, who used to be athletes. They both ended up with lots of disability. So it's never too late to kind of get involved in exercising. So, and we talked about growing your brain. There's that BDNF, cell connections, neurotrophic factors. That's brain-derived neurotrophic factor. We talked about that. So, living the active life you know, taking on new things. So, as you know, a number of years ago, I got challenged to run and run a half marathon about 5 or 6 years ago, and I've been doing it ever since, and that's me finishing with my daughter. I didn't think I could do that, but I took it up, you know, later, and it's been really helpful for me. So you don't have to run a half marathon, though. You can exercise 3 times a week, aerobic exercise. That's kind of the U.S. Preventive Healthcare Task Force is about active. Walking is a great exercise. Walking is great. And so walking briskly 3 times a week, at least 30 minutes, will help maintain your health. So we talked about eating. And you know that healthy diets, less fat, fruits, grains, vegetables, vitamin supplementation can be helpful. After the age of 50, calcium supplementation with vitamin D. You have to have both together to decrease osteoporosis. And then, again, omega-3 fatty acid probably is one dietary supplement. I don't take it, but many people swear by it. The Framingham Heart Study has shown that if you take a baby aspirin every day, that you're less likely to have strokes and heart attacks when you get older. I should be doing that. I'm not doing that. Maybe I'll start after this talk. But my dad actually was part of this physician study, and he still takes, he's now 94, still takes an aspirin a day, and was part of that study originally. Prevention. Know your numbers. Know your cholesterol, your LDL, your blood pressure, and maybe your waist circumference. These are probably among the four things that are most important in terms of your kind of health. So cholesterol, particularly LDL, blood pressure. These are things that are correctable. We can treat these. We can help you to get your blood pressure down and get your lipids down. So what do we know about the importance of kind of these sorts of things? Well, the centenarian study in Boston has looked at people 100 years and older, and almost everybody, few of the centenarians are obese. They're almost all lean, particularly the men. The women tend to have a little more body fat, which is normal as you get older. Smoking is rare, and they're actually better able to handle stress. Kind of interesting. So another part of kind of getting older, and this is, I kind of added this in, but this is kind of taking charge of your health. And you probably know that at Dartmouth, you know, we really are trying to encourage people to be engaged in shared decision making and to really ask questions. You should be the person who is the steward of your own health. And doctors don't know everything. They really don't. And so the question is, when you think about your medical visit, hopefully this is not what you experience. Whoops. Let me see. I'm sorry. Hopefully, this is not what you
do. Not arouse the wrath of the great and powerful Oz. I said come back tomorrow.
If you were really great and powerful, you'd keep your promises.
Do you presume to criticize the great Oz? You ungrateful creatures think yourselves lucky that I'm giving you audience.
audience tomorrow instead of 20 years from now.
Oh.
The great Oz has spoken.
Oh.
Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain. The great Oz has spoken.
Who are you?
Oh, I am the great and powerful Wizard of Oz.
You are? I don't believe you.
No, I'm afraid it's true. There's no other wizard except me.
You humbug!
Yes, it's exactly so. I'm a humbug.
Oh, you're a very bad man.
I'm probably a very bad doctor. So, you know, hopefully, again, we've gotten beyond this. But it wasn't long ago where, as you know, I mean, doctors, you went in, you did what the doctor told you what to do, and you didn't question the doctor. You did, heaven forbid, if you asked, gee, I'd like a second opinion, or is that medication really really good for me, and what's the data on that? You know, we really believe strongly that the best thing you can do is be an informed consumer, an informed person with respect to your health care. And that the more we can kind of equip people with the information they need to make good choices. There's some things where there probably isn't much of a choice. If you show up in the emergency room and you have a broken hip, we probably should admit you. And you probably should get it taken care of, pinned or whatever. But if you have breast cancer or prostate cancer, there really isn't one answer. It really depends on how you weigh risks and what's important to you. And that's true for lots of medical decisions. And so Dartmouth, as you probably know, has studied that. And there's lots of so-called of choices that can be made in terms of some of these preference-based decisions. In other words, a lot of things are weighing one versus the other. And it's not about us telling you exactly what you should have. So take charge of your care. So prepare for your medical visit. Write down your questions. Prioritize them. If you're not sure that your doctor knows all the medications you're on, brown bag. Sometimes we like to look what we're already on, because sometimes people who haven't seen a doctor for a long time, they're on that medication that was prescribed by the dead physician that hasn't been around for the last 3 years. Nobody knew. Ask questions about alternatives. Take notes frequently. We're now interested in whether or not not only bringing in a colleague or a person or a so-called a health advocate, but there's also research going on people tape recording their medical encounters. You know, of course, you might imagine some physicians are not that excited about it. In case things don't work out very well, you've got a tape recording when you show up in court. But you know, we think actually this is your visit. We actually believe here that you should be able to tape. So then we talked about connecting. Social isolation is poor. As I mentioned, it's associated with more mortality the more isolated you are. So this is this issue of, again, aging in community. And you probably remember this.
Tap your heels together 3 times and think to yourself, there's no place like home. There's no place like home.
There's no place like home. There's no place like home. Wake up, honey.
So you remember the all the characters reappear, you know, as the farmhands and others. But the point here is that so the social support that you experience is really, as I mentioned, important. And we like to talk about, again, aging and community and civic engagement, socially enriching experiences. Finding meaningful things that connect with other people we know makes a difference. I've referred to this already. Death 6 months after heart surgery, 2% people who are involved in groups and also who have some sort of thing they describe as a religious belief, a spiritual belief. No group, but having some sort of spiritual belief. No contact with other people isolated and no spiritual beliefs, highest death after heart surgery. That doesn't mean you have to join a church. It does mean having some sort of sense of meaning is important, and certainly your being parts of peer groups is important for your health. So this is actually data that social groups and some sort of spiritual meaning of some sort makes a difference in terms of your cardiovascular health and outcomes after heart surgery. Really interesting. The last thing that we're talking about that is part of what you probably know about is writing your last chapter, what I call being your own wizard. Don't let doctors or other people make a decision for you that's not on your behalf. Make sure that you've obtained advanced directives. We can help you here at the Resource Center in terms of developing end-of-life care, advanced care. Make sure that people know what your preferences are. Have an advanced directive. My wife knows exactly what I would want if I end up getting irreversible head trauma, and if I don't have the capacity to wake up. It's not to send my life being being in an ICU, on lots of machines and having medical students, around me. But everyone has their own person. This is a personal preference, and you can actually be very specific. There's a thing called a PULSE that Sandy Burstein, who's a wonderful geriatrician at Nashua, who's now helping us in the whole DH system to think about how to get people very detailed descriptions that are really very specific on what you would want in different circumstances. The more you can be specific, the better. And then have that written down, and then have a healthcare proxy, someone you trust who's going to be there to make decisions. So I'm a healthcare proxy for my mom and dad. The assisted living facility or the continuing care retirement community where they live know that if something happens to either one of them and they can't make a decision, I make the decision. And I know exactly what they want. I've written it down. My dad actually makes the joke that he wants to have DNR put on his do not resuscitate on his forehead, tattooed. He does not want someone doing this. He actually has had cancer. He had his chest reconstructed. And he doesn't want to be on, if someone does do this, first of all, they're going to crack the bones. But secondly, he doesn't want to be on a machine. He's had a good life. He's 94. If God takes him, he's ready to go. But often, unfortunately, those things aren't known, and the first thing emergency responders do is start doing this and doing this and, before you know it, doing this with the tube. And so being clear about that is really important, expressing your preferences. So these are the things that I've tried to kind of underscore. Maintaining mental vitality, maintaining and sometimes optimizing mental vitality, that includes challenging yourself in terms of cognitive stimulation, in terms of social stimulation, in terms of vascular health. Relationships, again, make a difference in terms of both social support, having people around when you need them, when you need assistance and transportation, but also it's good for your health. Sleep and protecting your sleep and figuring out a way to optimize it, knowing when you're kind of messing up your sleep by eating things or drinking things or medications that fragment sleep. When you get older, it gets fragmented naturally. Dealing with stress, really important. Living an active life, again, walking, exercise, sometimes weight training, all really important in terms of your brain health and cardiovascular health and good outcomes. Nutrition, prevention, preventing disability by keeping the functioning you've got. Being an advocate for yourself in healthcare, knowing what your options are and advocating for them, and don't take no for an answer. Connecting with your community, and then writing your own chapter, being the own steward of your health. That's kind of, do you want to hear her sing Somewhere Over the Rainbow? Or no. We could, but I'm happy to take questions.
Can your notes be available?
Sure, absolutely.
Online?
We can figure out a way to put them online. I'm trying to think about whether the Resource Center website could be. I'm happy to post them.
Be good. Back.
Be back.
And aging in place.
Yeah.
Everybody wants to do it.
Yeah.
Everybody is talking about it.
Yeah.
It's not good for you.
Well, aging, what I meant by this is, this is my opinion. My opinion is that aging in community is very good for you. Aging alone for most people in your home by yourself with nobody, not connecting with anybody, where you're not getting out, you're not being with people, but you are kind of only aging. I'm just going to age in place. I don't care what happens. I'm going to age by myself, you know, come hell or high water, and I'm going to be a, you know, if you want to cart me out of here, that's fine, but I'm that person who is socially isolated, who needs assistance as they get older, who will benefit from social contact. If they're not aging in community, it may not be the best thing. So I'm not saying that aging in place. We have had these aging in place forums that we've sponsored here at the center. We've had communities come in, including, oh, there's a deer out there, by the way.
Yeah. Yeah.
We have turkeys that come over the hillside sometimes.
Yeah.
So anyways, yeah, we have all sorts of wildlife that comes out of the woods there. So anyways, the so aging in place is a thing we aspire to in terms of aging and what you want, a setting that you want. But what I'm trying to make the point is that don't sacrifice being part of a community and being socially connected if aging in place means that you're going to be alone all the time. That seeking out and being part of other people's lives is really important. And there may be a point where some of us, for whatever reason, can't connect as much with other people when we're living in our own house by ourselves. And maybe at that point, you know, some sort of community type setting is going to be better for us. Some people end up in community-based or communities, living communities, and they are surprised they like it. Some people say, never. I mean, I know my mother-in-law, never ever will she ever go to a continuing care retirement community. She wants to live with her dogs. And there are exceptions, and I'm sure she'll be happier with her dogs, even if she's living by herself, because everyone loves her, and they'll come over and visit her. So, yeah. But is that clear? It's really about the community issue. I just have a problem with this idea of the aging in place, namely in my place, in my chair, by myself, come hell or high water. That, to me, communicates a message that's a little off in terms of the science. It's aging in community with other people in a social network. We're social animals. We just are. And we know that if we're not, we die earlier. Our immune system doesn't work better, et cetera, et cetera. Is that clear? That's what I mean by that. I mean, it's a little bit of maybe a fine point. Yeah.
So that probably ties in. I've read some of your work, and I think you had mentioned about training non-medical community health workers to go to people who are isolated. Maybe they can't get out.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that I'm kind of interested in.
Yeah, good.
Not having the proper background and medical, you know, different degrees, and wondering what the status is for people like myself.
That's a great question. Yeah,
like
that's
that.
Really great. Well, we're so what she's referring to is we wrote this article for the New England Journal of Medicine about kind of the kind of future kind of tsunami or whatever, and in terms of the need for helping all of us as we age. And what we know is that there's not going to be enough kind of regular healthcare providers, visiting nurses, to really, particularly in rural settings, to meet all the needs. So what we're thinking about is developing a core of people who are who may not have a professional degree to kind of be trained in being able to go out to people's homes who live independently to actually know a little bit about diabetes, know a little bit about falls, know a little bit about memory impairments, things like that, and to start to develop this capacity augmented by technology, being able to equip people with iPhones or whatever, to go out into people's homes and help people stay there. And so we're actually working with the community college system in New Hampshire to develop some so-called kind of courses and credentials. I've been talking to the Commissioner of Health and Human Services for the state about some of the licensing things that go with that, or the certification, special certification for this kind of special type of health coach or outreach coach. So we're working on it. We're not there yet. But we are very interested in the idea of developing curricula for people like yourself who are interested in either doing it as a profession that they may end up using it as a stepping stone to other professions, or as a part-time occupation to go out and to kind of provide outreach to people who are older, who may be living in their home by themselves, and having this core of individuals who can go out to do that. So we're working on that. We haven't hammered it out yet, but we're very interested in this model. So, and we think it's one of the solutions. You know, New Hampshire has the largest proportion of 85-year-olds and older in the nation as a proportion of the population. I don't know if you knew that. We're number one in the country.
Oh,
We have more people as a proportion of the population age 85 and older than anywhere. Very interesting. So what that means is we have fewer younger people who are around to kind of provide the workforce, and we're going to have more and more people who are going to need individuals who can go out and kind of help people to age in place, age in their community. And we think a combination of technology and sensors and things that kind of connect people to us in places like this, and also what we call high-touch, high-tech solution for this. So we're working on that in the center here. Other questions? Yeah.
There's so much controversy about different medications and things. They come out and say, this is good for you.
Yeah.
But then somebody else comes out and says, it doesn't really do anything for you.
Yeah.
And the fish oil was one of the things that
they
came out and said, is it worth taking or not?
Right. Well, there are nutraceuticals, and there's kind of natural things, and there's medications. And I think you should just be a skeptical consumer. You know, I mean, none of these things are likely to be by themselves, magic bullets.
No.
But what we are trying to do for medications that are prescribed, there's some researchers here at Dartmouth who are trying to completely change the information that you get. You know that wonderfully informative thing that's like about 4 pages long in your thing that's like microscopic print, that when you pull it out of the box of medicine,
yes,
it's so small you can't even read it, and it's got a list of side effects this long?
Mm-hmm.
So two of the researchers here at Dartmouth have said, you know, this is just stupid. I mean, nobody reads this thing. Nobody can understand
it. I'll read it.
And what they said, well, good. Well, you have a...
I've been reading it, too.
If you can read it, good. Most of us can't read it and understand
this.
It. So what they're doing is they're saying, well, you know, if you look at a box, cereal box, what you see is the nutrients and what's in it. In a very simple way, what if we, for every single medication, actually had a very simple, like, cereal box type of presentation? It has the risks, the benefits, how likely you are to get better, how likely you are to have a problem with it, what the side effects are. It's very simple. And so they're actually working with the FDA to make that a standard for the country. It's very cool. So you have readable information. So first of all, for medications, there's actually something you can understand. And it's simple and tells you how likely you are that it's going to work and how likely it is you're going to have a side effect. And it's all right there. The nutraceuticals or things that are non-prescribed medications are even harder because some of these things, the research on them isn't as well controlled. And some of the conclusions are made based on populations, like the red wine thing. It's not that they randomize people to red wine and not. They just looked at who's healthy, who isn't. What do you eat? What do you drink? Oh, red wine. So some of the stuff is, you know, you really have to take it for a grain of salt. But it's confusing. I completely agree.
Yeah. As we age, are we more apt to have side effects to medication?
Absolutely. No, there's no question that you're more likely to have side effects for all sorts of reasons. So one is that the same dose that you have when you're younger needs to be reduced as you get older because you don't metabolize the medications as well. Your brain actually and your end organs, the heart, the liver, the kidney, are also more sensitive. So even at the same blood level, even if we decrease the dose, your organs, your kind of heart, lung, kidneys, liver, are more sensitive to medications because you're losing a little bit more of the reserve. All those organs don't work quite as well. And so they're more sensitive. So you're more likely to have side effects. Then lastly, the biggest culprit actually is medication combinations.
Mm-hmm.
So we know that once you get above 5 medications, your likelihood of an adverse drug-drug interaction goes way up. So 5 is not a magic number, but after 5, and there's a lot of people, I've seen people on 20 medications, you know what I mean? So you can think about the combinations, remember your old math, combinations, permutations, you know, and you start to do it, and it just gets dizzying after you get above 7 or 8 medications. And so the more medications you're on, and sometimes they're all necessary, but the more medications you're on, the much higher you are likely to have what's called an adverse drug event, which is a serious drug-drug interaction. And adverse drug events are among the highest reasons for older people to end up in emergency rooms and hospitals. They account for almost half of hospitalizations and emergency room visits from people who have studied this.
My mother was in a nursing home and got a MRSA infection.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
And she was on all kinds of medications. So they put her on hospice. They figured she wasn't going to make it. She went down to 90 pounds. She wasn't going to make it. So they took a lot of her medications away from her. She lived to be 94.
There you go. Well, as I said to you, I mean, one of the secrets of geriatricians, of people who do geriatrics, is that often we do, the first thing we do is we, first of all, find out what the person's functioning is. We're not as concerned about whether or not you have this organ or that organ or that organ. We want to know, how are you functioning? How are you physically able and mentally functioning? And then, what medications you're on? And then we quickly look to see, are there any of these that could be eliminated? Because over time, people just kind of build these things up over time, and doctors are a little bit reticent to take them away. But sometimes it's amazing what can happen when you start to take away some of these medications that are unnecessary. Some people do a lot better. Yeah.
Some patients. One of my great joys as I get older is eating out.
Yeah.
I'm also on a 1,600 milligram sodium diet. I took my family to Applebee's Friday night. Today I looked at what I ate. I had chicken with portobello mushrooms that was 1,400 milligrams of sodium. My son had 3 cheese penne pasta, which was 3,800. And my 9-year-old grandson had something called a cowboy hamburger. I don't know what all was in it, but this is not counting the French fries. His was 2,900. Mm. Can you eat out?
I think it's challenging, and I think it's a matter of where you eat and how much you eat, and looking at the menu and heart healthy choices. It's hard.
I chose it because it had 555 calories.
There you go.
But it didn't say anything about the sodium.
How'd you find that out? Did you go to their website or something?
Oh, I did today. That's where I found it out. But
It's hard. I think it's a great point. I mean, I think eating healthy is really hard, and it's more expensive too. You know, I mean, I think everybody can't go to the co-op and get organic all the time, you know. And so we actually work with Medicaid populations in the state, and we have worked with what's called the community extension group that works on helping people to learn how to shop in stores on a Medicaid diet. It's hard, but it's doable. But it's challenging, yeah.
I just want to mention in today's Valley News, there's an article about how good vegetables are for you. Mm-hmm. So be sure to read it.
Go ahead.
And it said,
eat your vegetables.
It wasn't about older people, but it was that people who eat more vegetables are healthier.
Yeah, no question. Yeah. No question about that, yeah.
Sometimes doctors need to help out on these things. I have a friend whose husband is on a million medications, and if he ever was put on something, and the doctor says, do you think you should stop? He figures if he was ever put on it, it's valuable to be on. Right. And he had a hospitalization over in Europe, and they said, we don't even prescribe this anymore. But and his wife would love for the doctor to step forward and say, you know, maybe we could cut back on that, because he's in and out of the hospital.
Well, that's the problem. See, what happens is you accumulate these problems, and you get prescribed a drug for that problem, this problem, that problem. And then the assumption is that those are working because you're not dead. I mean, you're okay or whatever. And so often, these things, you don't look at whether the drug-drug interactions are complicated, or whether you really need two different types of antihypertensive, or two different types of this, or two
different thinner kinds of things, multiples, too.
Yeah,
and you're bleeding,
exactly.
Lots of nosebleeds and things like that.
Sure, and so blood thinners is a real great example. So sometimes getting having a pharmacist or having a consultant or somebody just looking at the whole thing, taking a new look, can be really helpful. And again,
he's driving his wife crazy.
Well, it's what the geriatricians do all the time, is they look at these medications and really think it through, and that's what we do.
What is geriatric anyway?
What is geriatric? Meaning how old do you have to be?
Right. it sounds like really old. I'm thinking you must deal with really old people.
Well, what we do, it's a great question, because it really, we know people, we all know people in this room. We know people who are in their late 60s who look like they're 80 and not functioning very well, and people in their 90s who are just, incredibly vibrant. And my father-in-law, who's right now doing income taxes in his business, and he's 91, and he's still doing income taxes. He's a partner in a big income tax business in Princeton. So, and he plays tennis and plays golf, and he's 91. You'd never know it.
Wow.
So, does he need a geriatrician? Probably not. But I think what we think about in terms of geriatrics is we tend to think that clearly people who are you know, 80 plus is where we kind of begin to really think that some people can really benefit. But, you know, not everyone needs to see a geriatrician. I mean, geriatricians are people who are specialized in geriatrics, are really there for the most complex people with multiple conditions. And most family medicine docs and internal medicine doctors, you know, we're trying to improve geriatric training so they understand, you know, that old people aren't just wrinkled young people. You know, they have different types of needs and different sort of things that that help with good care. So it depends on the country too.
So I haven't hit there yet. I'm not there yet.
Yeah, who knows? I mean, it's as much about functioning. That's why we kind of hedge around that. It really is around your physical functioning, mental functioning, whether or not we think about people, you know, being in kind of the geriatric age group. But it's safe to say that most of us feel that after age 85, you start to accumulate some things that that become more geriatric in their nature.
Okay.
That's really a pretty clear-cut point in many countries. And in Europe, for example, geriatrics, I think, is generally considered as something that's 80 or 85 and above.
Okay.
Whatever that's worth. Yes?
In Dartmouth Hitchcock, the only geriatrics department is in Keene. Why is that?
It's actually not true. We have what's called the Blue Team.
Yeah.
That is in Dartmouth Hitchcock. It's across the street. We have people like John Batsis and Margot Krasno and Dr. Dolkart. And others who are in a team of that's entirely geriatrics across the street. Mm-hmm. I talk to them all the time. Talked to John Bansis this morning. I'm helping him. So we actually do it. We're trying to build that. But you're right. There's a great geriatrician. You know, Lisa Lino in Keene is fabulous and does geriatrics in Keene. We're trying to build it out. And Sandy Burstein down in Nashua is a terrific geriatrician. He's the medical director. So we're working on it. Great. Well, we're past 5:30. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
Thanks for your attention.
Thank you. Thanks so much.